Great, thank you. As Alan asked me to talk about this months ago, I thought, oh, that'll be easy to talk about. And then you've probably been in the same situation. The meetings get closer and closer, and you think, oh, what am I going to say? Because this is not a new topic. People have been thinking about how to introduce new technology for a long time. Going back through some of our literature, looking, 1933, how do you get farmers to use this newfangled potash? How do you get your donkey to walk straight? Real complicated stuff, you know? So we're talking about nitrogen today, but I think how to introduce new technology and get this adoption is really nothing new at all. We'll talk about nitrogen in detail, and we're not going to talk about the cycle, but it's very slippery. So why are we trying to improve it in the first place? Well, economics, I'm just saying, if you want to get their attention, you better talk about what's going to the bank. And then the other drivers that are changed are these environmental drivers: nitrate, eutrophication, hypoxia, on and on and on. And if you're in California, in particular, where I live, all economics is almost a minor point now. There's so much environmental pressure that the farmers are really under the gun. We'll talk about that. Although some crops, they had a report about almonds recently that came out this summer. They said they're about 70, 75% efficient in recovering nitrogen from mature trees. So some of these crops are very good. And did you talked earlier about the corn that was in the 70s or more percent? When you get it right, some of these crops are very efficient. So we don't want to make the assumption that, oh, we're wasting all of this and it's the best we can do. No, we can do better, but it takes very careful management. Okay, economics. We talked about fertilizer prices. You've seen slides like this. I wanted to show you the one, the green line is Pacific Northwest. We don't produce any nitrogen in the Western United States, so we have some higher costs out that way. So that line is above some of the other ones. So a little more incentive, perhaps, to manage nitrogen properly. Okay, now let's get to, that was economics. We'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute, but here's the environmental part. Okay, this is from 2009. There's different maps like this. Just look at the red dots are over 10 parts per million. This is from a survey. You see there's plenty of red dots, right? Including down in the Los Angeles area, too. So is every innovation a good idea? Why don't we adopt new technology? Here's some technology from the patent office. This is an automatic candle blower outer for birthday cakes. I wonder why this never caught on. Here's another one. It's a timer in a fork, so you can set it and you'll know how long you've been eating. You think, well, this is 1995. It's not from the 1600s or something. Someone thought this was a good idea just 15 years ago and got it patented. So how come this isn't being adopted? It's new technology, isn't it? Here's another good one. Look at this hat. Would you like to patent that for all you football fans? Get that in your favorite team color, the goalposts and a little football. Can you imagine they patented this? 1993. Must have been a good year for someone's team. This is another nice one, 1998. Toe puppets. You put those on your toes and you can do a little puppet show. Patented, you know, 12 years ago. So I put these up here. They're pretty silly, but just because something's new doesn't mean, oh, we should adopt it. It's got to be better than what we had before. Though these are probably better toe puppets than I've ever seen. So just keep that in mind. Just because it's new, there's a process to go through to figure out, you know, does it make sense for what I'm trying to do? Okay, a little introduction quickly on Western North American agriculture. California is a big agriculture state. You don't see much in Long Beach, but maybe when you were flying in, you saw a little bit. Now, some of the students on Saturday went on a field trip to nearby Chino, which is a large dairy area. So I put two states up here, Washington and California, to give you some idea of what we're talking about. Doesn't really matter which of these crops we look at. Look at sweet onions, these non-storage onions. They're worth $12,000 an acre. So Glenn was saying, well, if I can save you $10 an acre on fertilizer, wouldn't you be interested? So you've got to be kidding me. If you could save me $1,000, I probably wouldn't be interested. I might be, but you know, they have so much invested in these crops. They have so much at stake. Fertilizer management, as he mentioned, you know, I don't even want to think about it. And look at the commodities that are grown in Washington. This is one of the simpler states in the West. And so we're trying to come up with recommendations for all of these. So here's the top 20. There's something for everybody. But California, we'll talk about their specific crops in a minute, but it's very diverse agriculture. So when you say manage nitrogen better, you say, well, am I talking about vegetables? Am I talking about fruits and nuts? Am I talking about field crops? Or am I talking about pots and greenhouses, which is a $3 billion industry? So this is going to be a pretty broad tour today of limitations of why we're not using nitrogen better, but you can see that it's a pretty complicated subject. Oh. And in California, you can see grapes are worth $3 billion between wine, table grapes, and raisins. And so there's a lot of money at stake on some of these crops. But times are a-changing. Not far from here, there's, you see, rose industry struggles with changing landscapes. This is not selling roses, this is selling rose plants. They grow these out in the desert for a few years and they dig them up, put them in the pot, and sell them. Nobody's building new houses. Nobody's buying new rose bushes anymore. They're letting the roses die, just dry up some places. Nursery operator Heinz files for bankruptcy. This is one of the largest horticultural operations in the country. Same type of thing. Nobody's buying landscape plants anymore. 900 employees, and they supply products to Home Depot, Lowe's, Walmart. Another very large one, Isley and Weeks, files Chapter 11. It used to be, these are the markets we said, well, they will use the technology. They're going to use these fancy micro sprinklers. They're going to use the enhanced efficiency products. They're going to use the controlled release products. Well, they're just trying to stay alive right now. And some of these potted plants, they used to give, it was about 150 parts per million of nitrogen in the irrigation solution. They're now cutting down to about 30 parts per million. They're saying, can we just keep these plants alive? We know we're not going to sell them this year, but we don't want them to die. So we're just trying to hold them for a year or 2 years or 3 years until someone might actually want to buy these things again. So they're looking to cut their costs and slow down the growth of these plants now. So things have really changed in the last couple of years. Golf courses, same thing. Well, they're the ones that are going to use the specialty products, right? Well, again, they're giving away golf club memberships at a lot of places just to get someone to come out and play. So the reality is changed, not just in California and the West, but lots of places. So you have to rethink some of these basic assumptions. Who's buying this technology? Who's buying the enhanced efficiency products? So distinct between an invention, which I showed you some inventions which I thought were a little wacky. Here's another one. Someone thought it was a good idea for a manure spreader. Get in there when the soil's too wet. Just fly it on, right? Or an innovation where an idea is successfully applied. It can be incremental, it can be radical, it can be revolutionary, but somehow these new ideas get applied out in the field for us. So there's some stages that go through when you get new technology adopted. First step is called knowledge, where you're exposed to this, but I don't know, that was nice. I heard something in at a soil science talk, and I don't really want to know more about it, but it was nice. Persuasion, okay, now I'd like to get some more information. I'm starting to get motivated now. Now I've got to make a decision. Am I going to use this or not? And now I'm going to implement it. Does this make sense for me or not? And then yes, I'm going to keep using it. So this is the process we all go through. It's not specific to agricultural products or fertilizer technology, but it's just human nature. And I think whatever you're trying to introduce into the marketplace of ideas, you go through these same steps. So back in 1962, there was a sociologist named Rogers who said, here is how we adopt some of these things. There's the innovators, and I'm not going to read all these. I want to pick out a couple things. innovators, willing to take risks. They are the youngest in age. We're going to come back to that age concept here in a minute. So they're the first ones to adopt. Then we get the early adopters. They are typically younger in age, have more financial lucidity, and we get the early majority. They're a little slower in the adoption process. The late majority, they're skeptical, and then the laggards. We don't want to be laggards, right? They tend to be advanced in age. And so you put those all on a distribution curve, and this is what it looks like. This is the percent of the market share that gets adopted, the early innovators, and then you get down to the laggards. So these are the young people, these are the old people. Human nature again, isn't it? Doesn't matter if you're talking fertilizer or anything. When the iPad came out, you saw the people that were lined up the night before. Not many of them had gray hair, I gotta tell you. You know, they were excited about this. They wanted to get it. They had to be the first one. You know, innovators, early adopters. I still don't know if I could tell you if I saw one. So people that don't adopt these early decisions, you know, they may not have the information, or they may have a real good reason for not adopting that. You can't just assume, well, they're out of touch, they don't know what they're doing. In this model that I explained, it assumes that you're voluntarily going to do that. The economists always think that human behavior is totally rational, and that's not the case all the time. And there's other things that take place, and that the desired outcome will always occur, and that's, we know that's not true either. Whoops. And so I want to talk about this voluntary thing, a non-regulatory approach. And for nitrogen fertilizer, that's becoming a thing of the past in some places. This is a proposal that came from the California Regional Water Quality Board. This has been revised, and it's coming out again in the next few weeks. But this is includes the area just north of here, all the way up to San Francisco. They said every farm's going to have a farm plan. They're going to account for all their nutrients. They're going to have a fertilizer, estimate their fertilizer application. And then they have to have their farm plan signed by a certified professional. Now, this is not a voluntary program because the farmers want to do what's right. Right? This will be a regulatory thing. And so the models sort of get thrown out when we do this. So uncertainty leads to insurance. We've all heard about insurance fertilizer before, right? Insurance is a great idea to protect against the possibility of loss. If you have a mortgage, you're required to have insurance because it's the smart thing to do. Something that's uncommon, but will be severely devastating when it happens. So insurance involves pooling the funds from many people to pay for potential damages. It seems like when we put insurance fertilizer on, though, we sort of turn it the other way around. One person's benefiting and society is paying the costs for the risk of that person that's over applying. So it sort of puts the concept of insurance on its head a little bit. So a little activity I want to go through with you. This is a game they came up with from Princeton called Stabilization Wedges. We're going to play the Stabilization Wedge game, okay? This is for climate change in particular. Oh, and I wanted to mention Todd Rosenstock at UC Davis, sort of the one that got me thinking about this, and credit him with this transformation. Okay, if we're talking about carbon, okay, from 1950 to 2000, we can estimate how much carbon was emitted from different sources. No wedges yet. If we stay on the same path, we're going to get up here by the year 2060. If we have a radical change, we're going to get over here. That's pretty straightforward. So we're going to look right here at that stabilization triangle. How do we do that? Is there one certain thing that'll get us from here to there? Well, no. In this scenario, I said there's eight things we're going to do. Each of those little eight things are going to have a wedge or a little impact on the big picture. So we'll skip over some of this. So here's something for global, for carbon, right? Efficiency. We can change our cars. We can replace all of our light bulbs. We can do these things that Thomas Friedman told us we should be doing. So that's a wedge that'll get us towards that goal. We can switch from fuels. We can go from coal-fired plants to gas plants. That'll be a little piece, another little wedge. We can capture carbon underground, for example. That could be another little wedge. We can switch to nuclear energy and reduce carbon outputs, another wedge. We can go to wind electricity, solar electricity. We'll install 20,000 square kilometers. This is in their game. That's a lot of solar panels, but anyway, that would be another wedge. Biofuels, another wedge. Natural sinks, change our tillage practices, all kinds of things. So all of these things would go into reaching that goal, not one thing by itself, but many little things that would contribute to it. So we're stuck with this nitrogen game now. How do we get our nitrogen budgets from being out of balance in many places? In California, they are out of balance for sure. We put on a lot more nitrogen. We import a lot more to the state than goes out in a way that we want it to go out, at least. And so what will it take to get down to the nitrogen budget that we feel like is sustainable, you know, in accordance with society goals? So first of all, we've got to come up with this mass balance, and this is where we were before, then we started here, we're here today, and if we just keep going, it may get worse. So how do we get to where we want to be? I wanted to mention two big projects in the West that are tackling this. One is at UC Davis called the California Nitrogen Assessment. They received a large grant to look at how nitrogen is used in California. They're doing some great budget work and management practice assessment. And also at Washington State, their INSPIRE program, where they're training young scientists to tackle some of these nitrogen issues. Anyway, they're both great programs. I encourage you to find out more about them if you're interested in this. So this is an example of what they're doing at UC Davis. They're doing all the sources of nitrogen and where they're coming from and where they are going. And this is not a final slide, so these are intentionally a little blurry, okay? But let's look at the situation in California, just because I couldn't do the whole West. Here's the Salinas Valley. You look at the red dots are over 20 parts per million nitrogen. And here's how it's changed from 1993 to 2007. Again, the red and the orange are increased in the last 14 years. So we're high and we're going higher, some of these places. So we've got to do something, some wedges, to get that line to come back down, because this is not acceptable. This is Tulare County, so I'm looking at domestic wells. The red, this is in the Central Valley of California. You see the red dots that are greater than 10 parts per million nitrate nitrogen. So it's not an imaginary issue. Okay, so what are some of the wedges? This is a great exercise to talk with some of your farmers and say, well, what do you think you can do? Just a little piece to get that line to come down a little bit. And they come up with some very insightful things. So as preparing for this talk, I called a lot of people and talked to people and said, why do you think we're not doing as well as we can? And I think everyone in this room got skewered to some extent, depending if you were a grower or in industry or in government or academia. Everyone was unhappy with what we have. Well, the first thing is water management. I think if we can't manage nitrogen in the West where we can precisely control the water, what hope is there anywhere else? You know, so changing from these flood irrigation systems to micro sprinklers, for example. Okay, some barriers from industry that people talked about. The crop advisors don't always know what's going on. We've got to get them to field days. They have to see things. They're very visual often. We encourage the CCA program. But in California, there's 472 CCAs. And it's how many grapes by itself was a $3 billion industry? No, far underrepresented. 500 in the Northwest. You know, you can pick out your region, but we need more CCAs and they need to be well trained. I talked about the age barrier, that old people don't want to change. This was from California. They surveyed the pest control advisors in California, 3,000 of them. This was in 2006. 40% of its members are 55 years old or over 55. Well, you see the breakdown, 35 or 45 to 55. So most of them are at least 45 years old. Those are the ones that are most resistant to change. So we say, we've got some new technology. We want you to try it. And they say, oh, I've seen it before. These things come and go. It'll never work here. You know, I don't want to try something new. And you've heard all those things before. And this is in part why. It's just human nature. We don't want to. We're in our comfortable rut. Thank you. And I didn't appreciate what a transaction this is. It's a farmer and an advisor have a very close relationship. Their kids probably play baseball together. They may go to the same club. They may hunt together. They do all kinds of things together. It's a trusting relationship. It's not just, we'll sign my check and I'll come back next year. So there's a lot of sociology involved in this too. I don't want to get it wrong if I'm making advice for my friend here. I don't want to try something new. And also profitability is required at all the levels. The companies have to make money, and this is sort of a dirty word by many people in the public sector. You're trying to make money from that farmer? Ooh. Well, yes. And that pays the taxes for the university and everything else too. But you know, they're trying to make a fair profit, but profit has to be part of the equation. And understand the applicability of these things, that nothing works everywhere, including nitrogen fertilizer. So you can't, there's no one product that'll work everywhere. And then companies have to compete and say, well, my product's better than that product, and sometimes that gets a little messy too, and the message gets blurred somewhat. From the industry standpoint, you've got a new product, where am I going to put it? I've got these bins, I've only have so many bins, and now you want me to fill up another bin? Or now I've got to have a tank, and I've got to store this stuff? Come on, you know, I don't want anything new. I mean, these are real barriers. You think, oh, come on, they can overcome that, but they won't if they don't need to. And technology was talked about earlier, it advances faster than we know what to do with it. We're throwing them new technology. Here's some sensors, here's some water meters, here's some aerial photographs. Run this new computer program. And okay, I know how to sell UAN, I know how to sell DAP. You know, just leave me alone. I'm happy. You know, and that's the way it is. And the spatial and temporal variability just is beyond our ability to manage sometimes too. Okay, academia. Let's talk about them. This is from Timothy in the Bible. Ever learning and never able to come to a knowledge of the truth. That's the perception of a lot of academics. I think we could do another study on that. So, lots of stuff and no one's home. But you have personnel, you know, the universities are squeezed like crazy, no budgets. Little incentive for many of you to do applied research. That's not in this room, I see many of you that are doing excellent applied research. But as a university system, you realize that that's not the top priority. Multi-year studies are not usually appropriate for market development. You have a new product, you want to test it. You can't wait 3 years to get the results. Say, should we take this to market or not? I mean, you've got to make a decision at the end of that year, go or no go. Are we going to promote this or not promote it? Where you need a 3-year study to publish it, so you have conflicting interests often. And that knowledge may not translate to competitiveness, and often many of the university people feel shy about talking, being competitive, again, the profit nature of things. So the growers don't appreciate the university's constraints, and the universities don't appreciate the growers' constraints. Someone told me I'd go out of business if I followed the university recommendations. That was not in California, but it probably could have been in any of your states. There's not a high level of trust sometimes. And this is definitely not true. I'm going to show you some great examples in just a minute here. Okay, this is another one that came up. And academics don't use the right statistics. You're using mean separations wrong. You insist on a 95% confidence interval. But hey, we're just trying to make a little profit here. I don't need a 19 chance out of 20 that I'm going to make a profit. I want 50-50 is great. They don't like to accept third-party research from private contractors, but the university won't do it themselves. So how do you get this data? So there's some great examples of nutrient management and university research. I just threw a couple things up here. This is some work that Tim Hartz is doing, a lot of vegetable research. But he's responsible for doing fertility work for about $5 billion worth of commodities on these specialty crops that we don't know much about. Okay, growers, tradition is comfortable, especially with the older people, and most of our farmers are older. Cost versus return, it's easy to measure the cost, pretty hard to measure the return. Real hard. Who wants to leave a check strip? And reliability, will it work this year, will it work next year? Or it didn't work this year, but it might next year. Risk is a big barrier to change, and for vegetables, the produce broker calls the shots. You save some nitrogen. Your apples were 2 millimeters smaller. I don't want them. They're undersized. Feed them to the pigs. And that's reality. They don't want anything to go wrong. So for corn, if you underestimate the nitrogen a little bit, you might lose a few bushels of yield. If you underestimate it on a vegetable crop, you have nothing to sell. You've picked a lot, but no one will buy it. So there are severe penalties for under-fertilizing. And water management is really the key for nitrogen management. And we know how to do it, but getting it done in the field is difficult. From government, real quickly, some competing environmental goals. Okay, for nitrogen management in California, we have this Global Warming Solution Act. They said, farmers, no more nitrous oxide emissions. The Regional Water Board said, farmers, no more nitrate in groundwater. Don't let it go up, don't let it go down. So you figure out how to do it. So the farmers are feeling very squeezed. Can you guys make up your mind and, I'll try to do it. This is another example. The dairy said, methane generators are a great way to treat your waste. Then the air board said, don't burn your methane because that will produce NOx and that's a greenhouse gas. So some of these dairies that have built methane generators now are not allowed to operate them. So you get these conflicting messages that really put the farmers in a squeeze. Safety and efficacy hurdles from government. NSN is not allowed to be sold in California yet. Another one, NTEC, nitrification inhibitor, is sold globally, but not in North America. BASF said, too much hassle to sell it here. It's used very well in other countries, but we're not allowed to use it because of government hurdles. So like I said, there's lots of arrows to shoot at everybody. There's some knowledge and management barriers, two things we don't understand totally. I mentioned water management. You have sophisticated systems like this, and then they let it run for an extra day. And one of the extension people I talked to said, if I just stick to the basics, I can get the message across. Said, if I show pictures like this, or if I do a little cartoon, here's urea, and look, it moves in the soil. Here's ammonium. Doesn't move much. And then it turns to nitrate. So, just simple things like that. He said, that's the kind of things we need to do. Okay, we've got Thanksgiving coming up. It's the biggest celery picking season of the year. You're all going to have celery at Thanksgiving. Celery sticks, celery in your stuffing, celery somewhere. So, they put 200 to 300 pounds of nitrogen on celery, and the root system's about 6 inches deep. Very shallow rooted. So you put this nitrogen on, put on the water, and where's that nitrogen now? So think about that when you're eating celery in a couple weeks. This is a real hard crop to manage, and there's many of these vegetable crops that no matter how good of a job you do, it's hard to get the efficiency up. Real good. Some other things. This is the uptake pattern of grapes, that black line over the season. We don't have data like this for many crops, perennials or some of the specialty crops. And that's pretty complicated, isn't it? So if you're using drip irrigation, maybe you can spoon feed it, but corn and soybeans seem like a breeze to us. I wanted to finish with this model that I'm really excited about. This is Pierre Morel at UC Davis. They said, we're going to run an environmental model, this descent, and put it in with a yield model too. It's easy to say, we'll cut the inputs, and then the environmental model looks good. They're saying, well, let's check the inputs and then look to see what it does for yield. So I don't have time to go through this in much detail, but they did it for a county where UC Davis is located. Pretty diverse agriculture. And they said if we cut nitrogen inputs by 10% or if we raise the price 10%, what's that going to do to the market and which crops can least afford a cut in nitrogen and still be profitable on that yield response. So saying rice is the one that would not get cut. Sunflower, I think there's a problem with that, but pasture, they said, oh, you can cut the nitrogen on that and still grow a little bit. So they're doing some economic models along with environmental models. When we put these together, I think we'll have some real powerful tools and make some decisions on, you know, what's rational to do. Let's see. There it is. I got it in. Thank you. So we're looking at this, though, from so many. I don't want to talk about the four R's. I want to talk about all these things on the outside. Because we're dealing with things like social justice. Do the small towns have a right to have clean water? Should the farmers have to pay for that? You know, things that go way beyond the Soil Science Society and the Agronomy Society, but issues that are intimately involved with nitrogen management. So we know what happens when you leave out nitrogen. We don't want to just say cut the rate, like Cliff was saying, oh, yeah, they cut the rate all right. They also had nothing to harvest. But we can do a better job, and some of these technologies will be real helpful for us. Okay, I think I'll give it. We're all done for the day then, I guess.
Any questions for Rob?
Cliff.
Maybe just a comment. It seems in California that the Water Resources Board here does a fairly good job of informing the public of groundwater nitrate concentrations. They have a database that they publicize and hold public meetings about. And I go to other parts of the country, I don't see that same kind of information transfer to the public. And it's my perception that much of the public does not understand the water quality, nitrogen contamination concern. So it's hard for farmers to recognize the need when he doesn't understand its impact of his management on his neighbors.
Right. So where the influence of what one person does gets... the effect gets spread out in the whole aquifer, and you say, well, it's not my problem because I put on some insurance nitrogen or didn't manage it quite right, that everyone has to pay the cost, however. Yeah, so California, they're pretty good at letting people know what's in their water. And yeah, in the drinking water, you have to get you get something from your water agency every year to let you know. So... it's extremely diverse. This was sort of a real broad brush of California with not many details. So, okay, thank you.
Any other questions for Rob?
Okay, so right now I guess we would be in a discussion period. So we didn't maybe get all the questions answered from previous speakers, so we'll kind of go through them quickly here. Any questions for Cliff? On his first talk? No. Any questions for Bill on his second talk? No? Okay. Anything for Glenn? No? Okay. Richard? Okay. Anybody got anything they want to get off their chest in a discussion period? I guess not. So before I adjourn, one thing I will... Oh, yeah, Bill.
You know, we've seen the four R's all day today, which deal with the social, the economic, the environment. We've talked about political. We've talked about agronomic. But in the Chesapeake Bay, we're not bringing all these pieces together. We're not bringing the knowledge from the universities to the state agencies, to EPA. You know, we have rhetoric like from farm bureaus, like if we're going to do these EPA PMDLs, this will put 50% of the farmers out of business. But we have rhetoric like Secretary of Agriculture Russ Reddy in Pennsylvania of these environmental PMDLs will destroy our rural communities. How can this group of scientists help now actually put the four R's instead of just looking at agronomy, looking at the political side of this to be able to bring into dialogues in public policy the social aspects, the environmental aspects, the economic impact. So when Rob, you were talking about the barriers, I mean, whether it's the barrier that intrigues me is the barrier between university and industry. That the university can have all kinds of creative things, But it's the bottom line that the plant manager at the fertilizer plant says, what's this have to do with spreading DEP? You've got no place. So I don't know, Rob, how are you achieving in California getting over these industry retailer barriers?
I think we all wish we had a magic answer to those things. We've been struggling with, all of you have struggled with those things for your entire career. You know, how do you incentivize someone to change? So the universities go through the process of education and voluntary change, and that's a very slow process. As IPNI, that's what we have done too. We say, you know, here's the information, you're leading the horse to water, but that's not always fast enough, unfortunately, as you're pointing out. Now, Cliff.
Rob, when I visited you in part of your region out here several weeks ago, we visited a local fertilizer dealer who is also expert in advising growers how to manage nutrients.
Mm-hmm.
And I recall him pulling up a database and sharing representative information from different farmers and how effective they are in managing nutrients. And basically, he had information that no one else has. And because of his relationship with the grower, he was in a position to advise them and encourage them to change. I think it has to start there. You mentioned the grower trust to the and the advisor relationship. If we don't have that trust and the professionalism of those people, we're going to get nowhere, because there aren't enough of us to work one-on-one with growers to accomplish that. Somehow we have to strengthen that, but I think it starts with empowering those local dealers with the information tools, and maybe we need more of those people like that individual out front of other CCAs to let them see how that person is succeeding.
And like I started off the talk with, we're not always rational beings either. We're told we should exercise more and eat less this and that, and that's nice, you know, but so I don't know what their answer, you know.
You know, because we've been talking the last 2 days about public policy getting ahead of science. Maybe there's a third leg on this stool, which is science is not getting implemented to be able to demonstrate to the regulators that they don't have to regulate more. In other words, if all the farmers were adopting the knowledge and science on nutrient use efficiency, or as Cliff used the term of, you know, limiting nitrogen excess, would we be forced into these public policy situations at all? So maybe it's not just public policy ahead of science, it's if we would be getting science implemented to more farmers and to a greater intensity of farmers, would be our best weapon against regulatory policies.
Well, many of you have worked on this too. I know, you know, you've all tried to get good recommendations on the ground, so it's not unique to the three of us standing here. I'd appreciate your comments too on how do you get good science out into the field. So let's, if that's okay, now let's open this up. And Alan, you had a comment too, and I'll move, let you moderate.
Bill, the question you posed was exactly the question that Dave Mangle came to me with when he said, we really need to address this because we have lots of nitrogen management, best management practices, technology, whatever you want to call it. We have new things coming that are being proven and demonstrated, but they're not being adopted to any great extent, a lot of these things. And how do we get farmers to adopt that? So that is the very question that Dave had in mind when he suggested this symposium. I don't know whether we've answered that question specifically, a lot of ideas around that. I don't know what the right answer is, but I'll share a little bit of information from some grower focus groups we did a number of years back, in almost a decade ago in the Midwest. And I really don't think this has changed a whole lot since then. Two groups of about 12 to 15 growers each for 2.5 hours or so of interview by an independent third party. So, you know, we were not identified as a company, but we hired someone to do this, so it was blind. And they were asking a lot of questions about farming practice, but specifically getting down into nutrient management decisions. And a couple of things were quite enlightening. one of the questions they were asked was, how do they rank the different decisions they make in the importance on the final outcome of their crop, yield, quality? And number one, and this is the farmer's perception. This is how the farmers answered the question. It may or may not be true in all cases, but this is how they answered. Number one was variety selection. So that's what the farmers perceive is the most, has the biggest impact on the final outcome, picking the variety. Number two was nutrient management. Nutrient decisions were second in their minds in importance to variety selection. Then the next question was, or another question was, how much time and energy do you spend in making all these various decisions? So there's a long list of things that they listed. So rank them in order of the amount of energy you spend. Number one was variety selection and picking the right seed, the right variety. Nutrient management was down near the bottom of the list. So the growers are saying, we know it's important, but we invest relatively little time and energy in making that decision. Now, there may be reasons for that. Maybe they're relying on someone else to advise them on that decision. Maybe it is really routine. A lot of them express, well, you know, we've been doing this, and you know, this works, and we've been doing this practice for 10 or 20 years. So a large extent, they said they had become routine decisions. And I think that's a bit revealing in that the growers know that it's important, but for one reason or another, they're not investing concomitant amount of time and energy into that decision.
Well, I don't think they have the data. In other words, if you look at, Harold has a lot of experience in this. When you look in the commercial setting, the number one interest is in seed, and matching yield monitor data to planting data, whether it's Branson, Illinois with SeedRx, or Sanders with Opta Grow, or any one of these examples. Because it's easy to take, this is what I planted variety, match it a yield map. But on nutrients, when you start saying about, okay, where do I apply manure? What rates did I do nitrogen? What did I do phosphorus, potash, sulfur, zinc? You've now got to, and now compare this against varieties, against soil types. You've got an immense amount of data that a farmer doesn't have the ability to analyze.
Maybe not, but we do know a great deal about those nutrient management decisions. No, it's not perfect. But I think that the purpose of the symposium was there are gaps between what we do know and what's being implemented, and how do we bridge that gap? So. Mm-hmm.
Terry.
I've got a comment as well. I think in moving new innovative processes forward, I'm finding we work with about 350 crop advisors throughout from Minnesota through California. And I think the key to moving the innovations forward is allowing the education of the crop advisor to take place. It's, I know both Rob and Cliff has mentioned this as well, but I'm thinking that more and more, if you can allow the crop advisor to have ownership within the technology, and so he understands something that's maybe not necessarily simple, but if he could understand the concept, and then he could share that new knowledge with that trusted grower that he's got more than just a business relationship with, but more of a social relationship. And then as educators, through the university or through industrial agronomists, you just cannot give up on moving the technology forward. Part of our process is to just repeat the information and repeat it. And it's still, I have to say that it's still a challenge to have some of those ideas move forward. In the area of enhanced efficiency fertilizer materials, out of that 325 or 330 crop advisors, there's still only 50% that are even selling any of, any of them. And others, they embrace the technology and 100% of their nutrient management fall into those categories. And I know there's a lot of other examples, but allow the crop advisor to have ownership and not necessarily then they can move to the grower, and then never give up on their educational process to vocalize those new innovations that could allow some changes to be made across watersheds and within nutrient management considerations.
Well, I think one of the things we talked about today is risk. And you're just bringing up the risk of the crop consultant advising a customer to do something new. And if it doesn't work, what that does to the crop advisor's reputation. But there's also a risk for the farmer that we need to understand. I remember this spring having a conversation with a farmer in Indiana on the phone about ESN. He was running 3 combines and stopped them to get on the phone. He said, boy, ESN would really save me a lot of labor. I'm hauling, 10 gallons per acre of starter fertilizer. If I could put that all on broadcast with ESN, have it there. So a lot of labor, a lot of cost savings. But he said, I can't risk, 5,000 acres of corn to try something based on some test plots that were done at Purdue. I can't risk that. There has to be some other gap, some other technology transfer step to satisfy the risk management need of that growth.
Yeah, and I think what it comes down to is that the many growers want to do and do demonstration evaluations within their own field. But I'd also say that many growers have a trust of a crop advisor that if they embrace the technology, they're accepting that the movement of that to innovation, maybe on a smaller basis, than the 5,000, 10,000 acres, but they, that trust relationship is where the crop advisor, they tend to move things forward more rapidly.
Yeah, some good ideas. Any other comments?
How about the university people that are stuck in the same dilemma? No.
Just one thing that I've been trying to focus on in some of the talks that I give to producers and consultants is I ask a question in terms of the inputs. Which inputs give you the greatest yield? The greatest yield boost. Get them to think in those terms. Because it starts for us, in an irrigated situation out west, of course, water might be number one, with the greatest return from the investment. I don't know. But where we're at with nitrogen is a big one. And so we try to get it in those terms so that they'll think about it. more than just, because fertilization, let's face it, most farmers, it's been an easy task. And it's almost, for some, an inconvenience that I just got to put this fertilizer on. But they know it's got to be done. But I think they need to think more seriously about it so that they'll be a little more precise about it. There was one time, talking about new technologies, and I gave 10-year data of no-till cotton to a bunch of consultants and farmers. The guy in the back row asked me, he says, well, how long are you going to keep doing this stuff? So my question to him, I returned the question back to him, I says, how long do I need to keep doing it for you to believe it? He didn't have an answer.
Okay. Well, good discussion. I guess 2 things before we go. This afternoon, there's a session, I think it's 3:34, which is going to talk more about some of these new technologies, kind of give some more specific examples. So it's going to be in this room after lunch, so definitely come in and check that out. And before we go, let's go ahead and give our speakers another round of applause.